It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Chelmsford man Steve Hughes has had to learn how to live his life without his vision. The 38-year-old, who works as a coroner's officer in Westminster, has Stargardt's disease. It's a genetic condition that means he only has his peripheral vision at best, but in the last 2 years, his eyesight has rapidly deteriorated. Before, he was able to go about relatively independently, but that's not the case anymore. But through the pain of losing even more of his eyesight, Steve has found inspiration in running, and he has also set himself the daunting challenge of taking part in 10 exhausting sporting events. He's doing so in order to raise money for a very worthy Chelmsford cause, the Sanctus Homeless Charity. Brought to you by Essex Live, this is Humans of Chelmsford, and this is Steve Hughes' story. Steve, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast and telling us about the rather extraordinary challenge you've set yourself.
You're welcome.
And obviously there's a lot of messages I think we're going to talk about and delve into throughout the course of this discussion as well. The first part of which I'll talk about, because that's kind of the reason you're doing this challenge in the first place, and that's the condition that you have, Stargardt's disease.
That's correct.
Which is an eyesight condition. Do you mind starting off by telling us what it is and how it sort of affects your life, really?
Yes, certainly. So, yes, as you quietly said, my condition is called Stargardt's disease, and my condition is stage 3. So what this entails, I have only my peripheral vision and no central vision at all. I can develop the condition when I was 8. It was something that is a genetic condition, so I was born with it, but it, say, the condition didn't change until I was about 8 years of age. My sister also has the same condition, and she is 3 years older than myself. So it all started off really with my sister, with the condition and the symptoms that was occurring. So they always closely monitored me from her. But they always thought there was a high percent chance I wouldn't catch the develop the condition itself. It happens in siblings, but not as common. It's like a 1 in 4 chance of myself catching the or developing the condition, and of course I did so. And it all, say, basically, one day I was at school. You know, I was always used to be sitting at the back of the classroom, used to have no problems whatsoever. And then all of a sudden, one day, I was like, oh, I can't see what's on the blackboard back then, or chalkboard, should I say, I'll call it. And that was when they first realised my condition was probably going to start to change in the same way as my sister's did. So then, as a result of that, I then was seen by the doctors where I used to attend at North Middlesex Hospital, where I went under a numerous amount of testing, where it was confirmed that I had developed the same condition as my sister, Stargardt's. So like I said, it's a genetic condition. So it was never obviously something that can be passed on directly. It only is if you're carrying that particular gene or a gene that was like my mum and dad were, which clashed, and it obviously was part of the sight condition itself. It could have been anything. It could have been hearing, it could have been physical, but you know, within this type, it was the sight itself that was affected. And from that, it's say it rapidly changed quite quickly when I was eight. That seems to be how the condition itself works or develops, should I say, where it just detaches the central vision quite quickly and it just goes. And there is no treatment at the moment. You are able to get certain kind of magnification equipment that you can use, but there are no glasses that can assist with correcting the vision because the vision is gone. So there's nothing there to obviously assist you with. So the way it would affect your day to day would be you certainly wouldn't be able to look at things from far away. You couldn't read bus numbers. You know, if you were walking along the road, you certainly wouldn't be able to see road signs that clearly until you were very close to them. But you know, on a whole, I tried to, you know, live, or our parents tried to ensure that we lived as a normal life as possible, doing the things that we wanted to do as best we possibly can and not letting it stop us. And it's kind of always been the stepping stone and this, you know, of how I've led my life. I don't let anything stand in my way. I will give it a go, and if I can't do it, I will let someone know, but I certainly won't be told I can't do it unless I know myself that I can't. And that's how, you know, you kind of get used to the conditions, so you find your way around the dealing with things in different ways to be able to cope. And you have certain different equipment that you can assist you with, like say magnification, magnifiers. We used to have these really not very pleasant, funky, well, unfunky glasses that were provided, like little telescopes on frames that you could watch the TV with, but me and my sister tended not to use them and would sit very more closer to the television. And that is pretty much how we really cope. We used to have enlarged print documents, large print books, which allowed us to be able to continue, you know, in school, did at mainstream school, and just as I say, you know, carry on as anyone else, but with that extra support to be able to get you to be able to see things in a much better way.
Having someone like your sister there, mm-hmm. as well with the same condition as you, does it help having someone so close to you going through the same things that you were going through?
Yes, it does. I was able to see how she coped with things and kind of replicated it in some way, but also to my own way of dealing with it as well. And we are very close, and we just supported each other through it, you know, and we just worked out what was best for us and suitable for us to be able to cope with the condition and to just lead as much as a happy life or as our lives as we possibly can without it really causing too much of an issue. Yes it did, to certain times where you just weren't able to see it, but of course we say we worked around that to be able to deal with it when we were younger, and we just tried not to allow it to affect us and, you know, and keep us as happy as we could.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe when people hear what the condition entails, mm-hmm. they probably automatically try and think about how that's actually affected your life and your family, yeah. life up to this day. But hearing you speak at the start, it sounds like it's almost been the making of you and who you are as a person, if that's fair to say.
Oh, definitely, absolutely. Because I had to deal with these challenges at a young age, and I've lived with the condition now for 30 years, it certainly allowed you to think, well, this is the sort of person I want to be, and I don't want it to stop me from being that person. I would definitely say it has made me the person I am today, determined. I won't back down from a challenge. If someone says to me, do you fancy doing it, I'll go ahead and try and do it in all its glory as best I can, unless, like I said, it stops me. I can't physically do it. You know, I've jumped out of a plane, so, you know, it's done a tandem parachute jump, so it won't stop me from doing. If it's something I want to do, I'll try and do it as best I can, or if I can do it, I'll definitely try and do it.
In terms of the raising awareness side of things as well, because that is obviously part of the reason we're talking in the first place, is there enough awareness out there about the condition for people, or is there anything that needs to be done or enhanced to help people living with it?
I don't think there is. Obviously, if you look at the you can certainly look at the condition on the internet, and it brings it up and it tells you more about what the condition is, the different types of the condition itself, and what possible tests and that they've done out there. There is a lot of research going on regarding our conditions within the medical world, more so in America, but there is obviously a fair bit going on over here, trying to see whether they can find some kind of treatment that could not necessarily correct the condition, but slow it down. I know there is trials going on at the moment where they have done it with adults, but they're now trying it with children with the macrodegenerative diseases that are out there, to try and see if they can slow down the process and prevent anything further from happening, which is great, because that's such a huge step compared to what it was like when I was a child. We were just told, you know, there's nothing there. Maybe in the future, you know, maybe in your lifetime, we don't know, but certainly wasn't back in the days of my doctor's lifetime for them. But they certainly, you know, say, you know, medicine now has developed in such a way where they are able to look into things further, because now they know exactly what gene it is, and they test more for the people, what, you know, to confirm that you are carrying that gene, and they are then looking at further, say, trials and programs to see whether they can find something that can assist and, say, slow things down. But I don't think there is enough awareness out there. You know, when you're out and about, okay, you know, I now walk with an assistant with a white cane. For many, I never needed that until my condition itself in the last couple of years has obviously changed, where now things are very more blurry. I always used to have issues with night, where if you had poor lighting, it caused a big issue, because you just really aren't able to see much at all. But I certainly was able to get around without having to have any aids at all. But now I certainly don't feel confident enough to be able to walk around these days without having my cane. So say there's a lot more blurness now with my vision. There's a lot of times within the bright light I can see outlines of people close up to me, or outlines of buildings or cars, but not necessarily can tell you exactly what model the car is, or whether the person that's near and walking by, whether they're a male or female, until they maybe I can hear their voices, and you know, other obstacles that may cause a challenge, such as bollards, posts, pillars. If there's roadwork signs all of a sudden appeared from a normal route and it's quite poorly lit, and you know, unless my cane detects it, I may not necessarily know it's there until I'm upon it. And the road conditions in the streets around here are, as I've always known they're bad at times, but I have to say, with walking now with a cane, you can really find the potholes, the cracks, the divots, the unevenness of the pavements, the cracks in the roads. It picks it all up, so it makes it sometimes very hard when you're walking along with the cane for a nice rollable movement, because of what it's picking up. And yes, there are people out there that, you know, are very kind, that offer assistance, but there is also, there's a lot of people out there that still have that, I wouldn't say naivety, maybe it is naivety, or they just don't want to interfere, or they don't know how to, or they think that they may be stepping on someone's toes by coming approaching you. It's nice when people do come up and ask you. You know, there are times when I will say to someone, yes, it's great for your assistance, please. Or there are other times when I say, no, I'm okay, I'm fine, thank you very much for that. I'm okay as I am, but you know, it's very kind for your offering. But there are other people that are ignorant over it as well, and will walk in front of you, cut you up. They turn around and glare at you, and then realise something. Actually, no, I have a cane, and that's the reason why I've knocked them. But I do think that the awareness out there is not as much as it should be.
Having that change as well in the last 2 years, I'm not sure how much that has actually affected you personally. If it's something you've always carried, have you sort of lived your life with sort of an acceptance that things are going to get progressively worse, or has that changed in the last 2 years? Difficult to adjust to.
I've always lived a life to say, you know, there's always a possibility that there will be change, but we were always told when we were, obviously, when we were younger, that the condition itself would be pretty much as it is, but there might be a slight variation. And so I never really thought that my condition would be where it is now. I always thought, well, you know, as it, you know, we were always told that was it. You know, I won't have to wear glasses. It'll only be when I get older, more towards my latter end of years, that you just get aging deterioration with your condition, with your sight, but it wouldn't really affect you in any other way. So I'd always thought, well, okay, fine, you know, I'm happy to, you know, I can do what I'm doing now and I can carry on like that. And, you know, and that's always how I've led my life. And, you know, like I say, you know, there's always in the back, in, you know, in the back of your mind, that the possibility that things may change. But I try to think, well, okay, you know, this is how it is, and I'll carry on. And then once things started to slightly amend and change, then I realised I've got to do something about this, or it could be a situation where if my condition becomes too bad and I don't have things in place, am I going to be able to go out? Am I going to be able to live that independent life without relying on people? And that's not how I've lived. Yes, my wife is very supportive, and yes, she's very helpful, and so are my children, you know, my eldest son. You know, he's amazing when we're out. But I don't want to have to rely on that. And I shouldn't have to, because, you know, you shouldn't be made to feel that you need to rely on everyone all the time to be able to get out and about, when if you've got the right things put in place, it can assist you as best you can, which is what I'm trying to do. And I didn't ever want it to stop me. And, it, you know, there are people with other eyesight conditions that maybe don't have the same luxury of having that motivation or the same support network to keep you going, and to think, right, you know, you've got nothing to fear, you can go out and do this. You know, you just need to be able to get the right things in place to be able to continue. I can remember a few years ago when I was growing up, I was invited to a community centre because we'd done some fundraising, and there were people there that, you know, of my age or slightly older, you know, that had that negative. They had, you know, had a condition and they couldn't do things, or they felt like they couldn't do things. And me and my sister were saying, you know, you should never say never. You know, don't let this condition or your condition stop you from doing something you want to go and do. If you want to go and do it, do it. And if you find that something is preventing you from doing it for a minor reason, try and find a way around that and see if something can, someone can help you for, to help you do that. And we got told, you know, it's a brilliant attitude to have, you know, but you've got a better support network than us. It's not, you know, it's not as easy as that for us, but we understand where you're coming from. But I, you know, I think to myself, well, because maybe that's the way we were brought up, it allowed us to have that attitude, like, well, you know, I will go and try and do this. I will help someone if it needs helping. And, you know, and that's why even now I still have that attitude. And, you know, even with the site changed the way it has, I don't want it to stop me from doing what I want to go and do.
And that determination brings me on perfectly, really, to the next question. And that's the challenges you've set yourself and raising money for Sanctus Cafe. 10 running events in total. Just give us a breakdown of what they involve, because there's a bunch of different events there and they're all taking place on various dates as well.
They are indeed. So it all first came about that once I got back into my running, I wanted to set myself a challenge. Not maybe as many challenges as I have set myself, but I wanted to set some challenges personally, but also I also wanted to be able to raise money for the Sanctus Homeless Charity CAF. For two reasons. A, because I think it's a great worthy and a great cause to raise money for. There's a lot of vulnerable people out there that need the help and support, and Sanctus is such a fantastic charity that helps that day support for the people out there. But also because my wife, and secondly because my wife also works for the charity. But I wanted to say, set myself a challenge, and I thought the best way to be able to do this is to look upon with my running. It's something that I've always loved and had a passion for. We'll talk about my more running further later on. But a year ago, once I got back into my running, I wanted to say, like I said, some challenges to put past. And so I first decided my biggest challenge would to take part in the Saltmarsh 75, which is an ultra challenge that covers, it used to be a 2-day event where you'd run 75 miles over 2 days, but this year they have changed the actual event itself, so you're running 50 miles in 1 day, where you have to be, you have to finish the race later by midnight of the evening of the day you start. So that was my first goal that I wanted to set myself, and then from there I have decided that I would amalgamate some other challenges. I always fancied doing a triathlon. I always able to swim and running, but I always knew there was going to be a bit of a stepping stone with the cycling. And there's a gentleman that I do run with called Carl, who has done a triathlon before, and said, would you be interested in doing one? And I said, yes, I would. So we got ourselves together and we got ourselves a tandem, and we decided that we will go ahead and take part in a triathlon. So I thought, right, I think if I'm going to go and do this triathlon, I'm going to add this to my challenge. So that's was my second part of my challenge, and then it's then say multitude into 8 other challenges. So the 10 I've now decided to take part in is, firstly, will be the triathlon, and that is actually taking place this Saturday, the 17th of August. And then I decided to then add a half marathon onto that, and I identified a half marathon that was taking place in Clacton, and that is also then happening on the 18th of August. So I'm doing the triathlon on the Saturday, and then I shall be then competing in a half marathon the following day on the Sunday in Clacton. I then have added 2 further half marathons, which will take place in September. This will be one that first is in Chelmsford, which is the Pleshy Half Marathon, and then I shall be then competing in the Great East Half Marathon, which is taking place in Ipswich, also in September. And then I have then taken on the big challenge of the Saltmarsh 75 in October. And then I will also be taking part in a 10-mile race also in October at Tiptree. And then I will be taking part in another half marathon at the end of October called the Riverside Half Marathon. And then I've got 3 further challenges which will take place in November. One is another 10-mile race that takes place in Stebbing. I will then be taking part in another half marathon in Hertfordshire, and then I finish off. I think the Hertfordshire half marathon is the last one I take part in, and in between that, I will be doing the Chelmsford Road Race 10-kilometer run.
A lot of running there. Yes. I'm sure there's going to be some tired legs by the end of it as well.
I believe there will be. Mm-hmm. Yes.
But obviously, running then is obviously a big part of your life. And it's almost helped you, I suppose, in a lot of ways. And we were talking just before we started recording about how your sort of rediscovery of parkrun in particular, mm-hmm, has really helped you in a lot of ways.
Yes. One day, my wife said to me, she said, I'd like to see you, get back into your running, really. It'd be nice to see you go out. You always used to enjoy that. It'd be great if you could take part in it again. And I said, it would be great. I was doing some gym work at the time, going down the gym, but it wasn't the same. Running on the treadmill, going on the cross trainer is not the same as going out, running through the countryside, on the roads, and having fun, and just being in a different environment. So I said, I think I'd like to go out for a run one day. So I did. I went out for a run, and I ran the routes I took part in when I was training for the London Marathons and the Half Marathons. And I thought, I can't do this. I can't see enough to feel confident enough to be able to run here on my own, even over the fields. I thought, I'll run around the fields, there's nothing to trip over, I can't bump into anyone, and it still felt uneasy. So I came back home and my wife said to me at the time, how did you feel? I thought it went okay, but it didn't feel the same. I felt quite nervous about running. I wasn't running at the speed I'd like to be running at. And I just don't think it's physically going to be possible for me able to run on my own out and about. I think the only way I'm going to be able to do any running is if I just carry on working down the gym. So I did that for a period of time. I did some more gym work. I did some spinning. But I wasn't enjoying it because I thought, this is not where I want to be. So I stopped for a little while and I thought, you know, there's got to be a way of doing this. There must be something I can do to be able to allow me to get back out on the road and do what I love the most. And at the time, I was then looking into seeking assistance with having an assessment for a guide dog, because say, you know, because of the way my condition had changed, I felt, you know, I need some more assistance now. I had my white cane that I was using, but it felt like they may, you know, for me to be able to go out with my children, I just needed some extra stability and security with myself. So I applied for a guide dog assessment, and a lady by the name of Jill, that from the Guide Dog Association, came and gave my initial assessment and asked me what I was into. And I explained to her that I was into football, rugby, cricket, but my main real passion was running. But unfortunately, due to the way my condition has changed, I can't do that. And she basically said to me, she said, well, it's funny you should mention that you like running. I also assist another lady from Chelmsford who takes part in the Chelmsford Park Run, and she runs with a guide. Would you be interested in contact, if I put your name in contact with the lady that coordinates the guide runners for the Chelmsford Park Run? And my eyes lit up and I said yes, 100%. So she put me in contact with the lady Sue that coordinates the Park Run guide runners for Chelmsford, and we had a chat, and we then met up for the very first time a year ago, back in June, I think it was July time, and we went out for a practice run. I did not know how it was going to go. I'd never run with a guy before. I'd seen it when I'd taken part in other races when I was competing for visually impaired tournaments, but I'd never done it myself. So I never knew how it was going to be. I thought, you know, I wasn't nervous. I was looking forward to the challenge, but I was a little bit apprehensive because it's like I'm running with some person that's attached to me and I'm relying on them to be able to get me round. And also, because I hadn't run for so long properly, I didn't even know whether I'd even get round. So the aim was to take part in the to do with the 5K run, but to actually run the route of the Chelmsford Park Run. So, and it was in the Sunday afternoon, so the sun was quite high. And I thought, well, you know, here we go, give it a go, we'll see how we get on. I'm either going to get round in one piece or I'm going to collapse on the floor and think, what the hell have I decided to go and do? So we took, I met her up and we went out, and it wasn't fast. I didn't expect it to be fast, but I got round in one piece and I couldn't believe how quickly I allowed myself to relax and to put all my trust into this one person who I'd only met for that very first time when we went for the run. And we were talking away, she was giving me directions of where we were running, and I just eased and became more relaxed. And as the run went on, I felt more confident about doing it. And I was surprised. I did say, you know, like I said, you know, I thought it might be something that's going to be a real challenge, and you know, whether I'll be able to cope with it or not. But because I knew I wanted to run, I think that also allowed me to relax more, because it's something I wanted to do. And I thought the only way I'm going to be able to do this is by just letting go and allowing this person to safely guide me round, but I also stay upright. And we finished that, and then I did a practice run again. And then I then took part in my Chelmsford Park Run for the very first time, say August of last year. And from there, it's progressed. And it is the park run that, like I say, you know, that has really allowed me to get back into my running. I've met some great people through the park run. I've allowed to myself to make some new friends, and to allow myself to develop and meet more guide runners through the park run who I, you know, run on a regular basis with, and some of them that are who have assisted me with my 10 run challenge. And saying my confidence has grown from there. Within the park run itself, I then have a park run guide runner by the name of Paul, who was a member of Springfield Striders, and he suggested, you know, would it be something I'd be interested in going along to do, about joining a running club? And I thought, yes, I think it would be, to allow me to expand my running, not just with park run, but if I wanted to do something else, you know, to do more distances and maybe and meet other people. And I went along. They were welcomed me with open arms. They were really, really pleased to see that I was interested in coming to join their club. And I now run for them on a regular basis. You know, I train with them on a Thursday, and any competition obviously that I take part in, I'm always representing them in that competition. So it gives them also that extra bit of advertisement that they've got someone with a visual impairment running for their club, and it also allows me to get out and do my running. But this all came from park run, and say, like I say, you know, from the guiding group within the park run that's allowed me to do what I'm now doing, and it's brilliant.
Exactly, it's the liberating side of it. And to anyone who is potentially listening to this, mm-hmm. Who may have a vision impairment themselves, what would you say to them in terms of maybe trying to get them out there and getting them to meet a guide runner? Yeah. Because it does sound completely liberating for someone in that position.
Absolutely, no, definitely. I you know, if it wasn't for Jill, who put me in the right place, I certainly wouldn't have known that the guide runners existed at the park run. Maybe if I did a bit more research and bought a park run, it comes up on their Facebook page and website, but I didn't know they existed like they do. And I think if anyone's there, you know, lives in Chelmsford or anywhere, you know, in Essex or, you know, anywhere in the country that have a visual impairment and they want to take up running, and they feel like they'd like to take part in the park run, then contact your local park running webpage and see if they have a guide running group attached to them, or see where the local guide runners are and just give it a go. You know, it may not be something that you do it for the very first time, and it may not be something for you, but if it gives you that opportunity to think, you know, I'd like to go and run, and I'd like to take part in the park run, because it is such a community. You know, you don't have to be the fastest runners on this planet, and you don't have to be, you know, a great runner. It's the taking part in it, and if it allows you to do that, then I would be supportive of any single person that wants to go out and do it. You know, I don't mind anyone that wants to contact me and ask me questions about it, because it's, you know, it's got me to get out running again, and if it allows someone else to have that same excitement and give them something else in their life to think about, then don't let it stop you. Go and do it and find out and make inquiries, and I think it will make someone's life different. It'll maybe give them a reconnection to getting out and about if they feel that they can't get out and about, and it gets you to meet other people that you may have never thought you'd ever meet.
And as someone myself who takes part in the Chelmsford Park Run, I can wholeheartedly back that message as well. The final question I'll have for you is focused on Sanctus, where we're recording this, and we've touched on it earlier, but I suppose I want to give it the last word, because that's where the money is going,
of course.
The money that you raise. Yeah. So in a nutshell, just how important is this place to not just Chelmsford, but Essex, really?
It's massive. When you walk the town, it's or the city itself, Chelmsford, you realise exactly how much homeless and vulnerable people are there. It's everywhere. You know, whether it's walking through the park, whether it's coming through the cathedral itself, whether it's walking past the shops, you'll see them sitting there outside the train station. They're there underneath the railway arches. There's someone around, and you know, it's growing wherever you go, whether it's in London, Essex, anywhere in the country. You know, the vulnerability to homelessness is increasing. And Sanctus is such an environment that allows to help support those people in Chelmsford and in the surrounding areas. You know, there are people that do travel in, if they can, to Sanctus, because it's got such a family community here. You speak to the guys and the women that come in here, they don't have, you know, they won't have a bad word to say against the place. They absolutely enjoy coming in here. They feel a part of a family. It gives them a reconnection to other things. They feel worthy when they come in here. There's no judgment at all. They're not frowned upon. They are here to help support them. And they need that support to try and get through what a rough day they might have, whether it's the poor weather, the cold conditions, the sun, the, you know, the fact that they, you know, they don't know when the next food or next drink's going to come from somewhere that without, you know, with, depending on what they obviously are they're doing. But it gives them that extra, that support. It helps them with their day-to-day routines, try to get them the right benefit, the right connections to try and rehouse them, to maybe get them the right mental health if they're support if it's necessary, to get them doctor's appointments, because that's, again, you know, they live on the out in the multitude of conditions, and they might not have never seen a doctor for multiple many months or days or weeks or years, and they help support that by getting them enrolled onto surgery, just to get that, you know, assessment, and they are just, it just makes such a difference. You know, and they are, say, they just come in here, they have a chat, they sit down, they can have a hot drink when they want, they've got food, they can have a cake, they can have sandwiches, and that is all done by people that volunteer. You know, obviously they've got people that are here that are paid, but there's an enormous amount of volunteers that also are involved in obviously the charity itself. They get a lot of donations from other companies that are all collected by people that volunteer for Sanctus. They do food collections from Pret, from Sainsbury's, Marks and Spencer's, Tesco's, you know, they, Greg's, and there's others that also help donate as well. I'm sure my wife will frown upon me if I can't remember them, which I can't, but it's all support that they look for. They're always constantly seeking fundraising, you know, to help support and finance the charity, and it's a continuation of helping, seeking help, having the volunteers, as well as, say, you know, the few people that are obviously are paid by the charity itself, but a lot of it is done by the goodness of their own heart and just wanting to support and help those people that need that support. And say, it's not just homeless, it's vulnerable, it's families. You know, they've had families that come in here with children that have, you know, they've hit rock bottom and they literally don't know what else to do, and they just give them that extra help. You know, even if it's to send to the food bank, or say, you know, to take them down to the town hall to try and ask them for secret advice for housing, you know, and it is all done by just the goodness of their own heart. And there isn't many people that out there, or companies, or, you know, places that do what I think this charity does.
And certainly a very worthwhile cause that we can all get behind as well. And with that, I'll wrap up this particular episode. And thank you once again, Steve, for coming on, sharing your experiences, and obviously telling us about the challenge that you've set yourself as well. We will put a link to the Just Giving page in the show notes as well, so anyone who's listening can click through there, and they can donate to the cause through that. But with that, wish you all the very best with the upcoming running events.
Thank you.
A lot of them. I'm sure we'll be knackered by the end of it.
I'm sure I will.
Yes. Certainly a worthwhile cause.
Thank you so much,
Steve.
Thank you very much.
A big thank you to Steve for taking part in this series of the podcast and sharing his story. You can find a link to his funding page in the show notes of this podcast. Humans of Chelmsford is an Essex Live podcast and is available on Spotify, Acast, Apple Podcasts, or the Essex Live website. You can also follow the show's social media pages. They're on Facebook and also on Twitter. Join us next week to hear from our latest guest on this series of Humans of Chelmsford.